This is BBC. BBC Radio. Six Music.
Right now, it's Matt Everett's The First Time with Karen O.
Everett, and welcome to The First Time. This is the series where we meet some of the most influential and best-loved musicians around and look at the seminal first musical moments that shaped their lives and their careers. This week we meet the singer of a band that emerged from the New York City garage rock scene of the 2000s but tapped into a more experimental, left-field and lawless vein to create some of the most brilliant albums of the noughties, not to mention playing some of the most unpredictable and memorable gigs. And as frontwoman of this band and later as a solo artist, my guest has become something of an icon for her voice, for her lyrics, for her style and her total commitment to her art. My guest on The First Time this week is Karen O. In a rare in-depth interview, we talk about Karen's very earliest musical influences, Alvin and the Chipmunks, doo-wop classics The Troggs and Ashford and Simpson, as well as her first ever live performance, something that changed her life completely, the very moment that Karen Lee Ozalek became Karen O. We chat about her obsessions with the punk rock scene, the Grateful Dead, she loves the Dead, like she really loves the Dead, and the impact of ESG on the band that would become Yeah Yeah Yeahs. And on that subject, we talk about the very first song Yeah Yeah Yeahs wrote, the impact of their success on her and this idea of her onstage and offstage personas, and the story behind their masterpiece, Maps. But the very first question I asked Karen, as I do with all my guests, was when was she first aware of music as a child?
I mean, pretty young, yeah. I mean, like, maybe like three, four. Yeah. Is that like not yet, not that early?
No, that's to be, yeah,
some
to be
people
aware
like
of it.
One and a half, like two. No, it was more like three.
What kind of thing was floating around you? The household?
I mean, you know, Michael Jackson's Thriller on the tape cassette, Chipmunks, Dude Country, you know, that was a favorite. And then there's some radio songs like We Are the World. I remember that.
Big
this,
song.
This is dating me. And the song that goes solid, solid as a rock.
Ashford and Simpson.
Sorry,
that's a good song.
That one somehow like sticks. That one stuck.
The thrill is still
Wasn't your dad big into doo-wop? Wasn't that a big thing?
Yeah, he had all these compilations that were like sort of the best of the 50s, best of the 60s, you know, and both like doo-wop and old country. And I got a bit of everything, like, you know, and there are a lot of, actually, there were a lot of girl groups on those compilations, which I loved, you know, from back then. But I think that like that seriously shaped how I write music, you know, and how I think about music, you know, up to now. And he had like best of Sam Cooke, and he had like a good mix. And he, you know, he loved the Beatles. The Beatles was his band. So I grew up listening to a lot of that stuff too. Yeah.
Is there a song specifically from that kind of doo-wop genre that sticks in your mind?
There was I Will Follow Him. Do you know that one? It goes like, you know, I love him, I love him, I love him, and when he goes, I'll follow, I'll follow, I'll follow. I will follow him, follow him wherever. Wild Thing by the Trogs, right? That's the Trog song, right? Wild Thing, you make my heart sing, you make everything groovy. Wild Thing, Wild Thing, I think I love you, but I wanna know for sure. So come on, hold me tight. I love you.
Wasn't that one of your first performances?
It was, yeah, you've done your thing. Yeah, it was. It was one of my first performances. That's kind of where I say Karen was born on the dance floor in New York City, just like at this Bar 13. But I think it was really actually, you know, performing the Trogs when I was in the fourth grade or fifth grade. I think it was fifth grade, yeah.
Can you remember anything about that?
I do. I remember it quite well, actually,
really?
Yeah. Because, the way that I did it was, like, I had these sunglasses that were so dark that I just couldn't even see out of them. They was just basically wearing, like, blindfolds. And because I couldn't see, like, you know, when I was performing, like, any of the audience, anybody around me, I just went totally insane. I went crazy, just, like, unleashed, you know? And I was, like, a really shy girl, too. But I was just, like, you know, I was losing it. It's because I just felt invisible, basically, because I couldn't see anybody else. You know, it was, like, as if I was dancing in my room. So that the early traces of that persona were like there from fifth grade, you know. So.
What was the first music you went out and you bought yourself that was yours? Because that's different to what you hear in your parents.
Yeah, I remember a couple singles. I remember getting Queensryche's Silent Lucidity. Do you know that?
I don't know a lot of Queensryche. It sounds metal. Is it metal?
Yeah, it's totally metal. It's metal, but that's like a ballad. You know, that's like, that was their ballad.
I mean, I don't mean metal in a bad way. Yeah. There's nothing wrong with metal.
Oh, no. Please. I don't know why. Like, I don't know how I came upon it. I like ballads a lot, so there's that one. Yeah, I didn't have great taste, I think, when I first started buying music for myself. I think it came a little bit later on. So, yeah.
What about the first gig you went to?
Let's see. The ones that, like, that my parents took me to, or just that I went to on my own volition.
The kind of first one that you were like, this is, I'm going, I mean, mine was Twisted Sister, but just, I mean, you know.
Right, right.
When you think, oh, this is going to be my first gig.
Thing is that when I was like 14 or 15, I grew up in Jersey, and I went to private school, which means I think public school here. I'm not so sure. It was like, but I had these friends who were not in private school, and they were like punk rocky, hippie, like dopey kids, you know, and they had like a band called CBC, Corned Beef and Cabbage, and they play at the local VFWs, which are like the veteran like sort of recreation centers and stuff, and we used to go to see their shows and stuff when they're like, it was pretty awesome. It was like a bunch of 15-year-old punk rock kids like getting together and these weird recreation halls, and it was a really great time. Corned Beef and Cabbage, you know, so that was But then after that, it was like Fish, you know.
Yeah, I'm like, there's a lot of diversity here, which is good. Yes. This is
a little bit of everything, you know. Yeah, so, yeah.
You're a Deadhead. You're a Grateful Dead fan as well.
Yeah.
Because I don't know whether it's just the fact that it's the UK English thing, but in England, I just don't get it. Mm-hmm.
I understand completely.
Kind of like, they're supposed to be this psychedelic band, but it just sounds like old man blues to me.
Oh, yeah.
Like white middle class blues. Like, when you say psychedelic band, we think Pink Floyd. We don't think...
Yeah, I never found their music psychedelic. It was just more like what attracted me and appealed to me about the Grateful Dead was really just like the happening of the shows, man. The shows were incredible.
Because that's it, because I've never been... This is that thing, the whole everyone getting in that space.
For like a nerdy, wallflowery, awkward teenage girl, I would like go to one of these shows and they'd be at like Madison Square Garden, right? Huge, you know, they're playing stadiums, you know? And outside of the shows, it was almost like a city of, you know, hippies selling all kinds of things, doing all kinds of drugs, and it was just like its own scene. Like, you didn't even have to go into the shows. It was such a scene, you know? And so going to one of those shows as like this awkward teenage girl, they're like, sister, come and show. It was like very culty, but I felt like for the first time, like in, you know, my high school years, unselfconscious, totally like embraced, you know, like accepted. And then you go into like Madison Square Garden, everyone's just like losing it, dancing. Like, there's just like this feeling of love was in the air. Like, people just loved going to the show so much, so the vibe was so up and you just could lose yourself. I guess it's like kind of equivalent of what people, when people go to raves and stuff, you know.
Okay.
But it's just like the community and like the whole like happening experience of it was just left such an impression on me. It was just like the first time I felt like I could completely lose myself in music and be completely free and self-conscious and not judged. It was like, as a teenager, it was like it was a dream come true that way, you know. So
that really meant something to you, didn't it?
Yeah, it made a huge impression. And like, and also just like just the passion that like the fans had, the Deadheads, they just follow the band like, you know, from city to city to city, and the dedication they had and stuff like that. Starting a band of my own, I was just like, it's not just a band going up on stage. We want to make it this, you know, a happening experience. Really just like make this crowd as unselfconscious as possible, like totally absorb them into the music, into the maelstrom of what we're doing up there. Just decimate any shred of being self-conscious, and so they can lose themselves.
Goes, the people all complain. Stephen Crawford in his time, well, he may and he may decline. Did it matter? Does it now? Stephen would answer if he only knew how.
When did you first hear ESG? Because this is an important band.
Oh, yeah. It is a very important band, yeah. They reissued their record in either 2000 or 2001. I can't remember quite the date, but came out just as I was like at NYU Film, and we were just starting the band, me and Nick. And that record came out, and I just thought it was like the coolest thing I'd ever heard, you know.
Those records still sound, they could arrive tomorrow.
They're timeless. They're so they're just like, it's just because they're, you know, so simple, some sick bass line, the vocals, so much attitude, just so like irreverent, badass, and catchy, you know, too, and so dancey, and just like a super simple, like, you know, beat as well. Yeah, it just made me feel, listening to it, I just like listened to it while I was looking, you know, in the mirror and trying basically like cop like I was I was like that. And so like, so those early you know, a couple of, like Bang, for instance, and stuff, one of the songs off of our first EP was me trying to cop that attitude and have that sort of, we did a lot of our early demos on like a drum machine, you know, too. So yeah, I was trying to get a little bit of that dancey New York, you know, tough New York kind of vibe.
Six Music.
The myth is that Bang was the very first thing you wrote with Nick. Is that actually true?
Yeah, I think it was.
No way.
Yeah, I think it was the first song. Yeah, after a couple of Brass Monkeys, you know.
That's amazing. Yeah. That's a lovely thing that doesn't happen very often when something just goes, okay, that's right.
Yeah, no, it was such a joyous, like, blissful moment for us because, as the story goes, we.
As the story goes.
As the story goes, we had come up with the band name. We came up with the band logo, which was the spray painted on these two bunnies before we came up with any music for the band. So, you know, we like kind of had this pressure all of a sudden, like, oh no, we have the logo, we have the band name, but where's the music? What's the music going to sound like? And then, yeah, then Bang came out and we're like, nice, we did it.
I like, you know, you draw the logo of your band on your book, school book, years before you even have a band. I think I don't mind.
That's usual. Yeah. I guess it. yeah. Okay, so maybe that makes sense.
What's your relationship with Maps like now? Because it's a strange thing when you have those songs. And I know from speaking to people, that relationship changes. Sometimes you're like, of course I'd love that song, I want to play it all the time. Other times like, I'd rather just, can we just, I love it, but can we park it? And other times you're like, I'm just sick of people asking me about it. So how do you feel about it?
I mean, I'm like fascinated by it. I really am. I am like endlessly curious about that song because yeah, it's just strange to me. It just, yeah, it's one of the earliest songs that we wrote for the record, for Fever to Tell. You know, I can remember it was like a daydream remembering that, you know, making that song. It was just, it just happened so kind of effortlessly, you know, so like sort of incidentally, like Nick just had this sample just kind of playing, you know, in his room. I was in the hallway, you know, I was walking past his door, I heard the sample, I came in, I was like, what is that? And then, you know, 5 minutes later, I was singing basically the lyrics to it. And then it just was there. It was like we did this collector's edition release of Fever to Tell. And there's like literally, I think there was just only two demos of Maps, like probably 5 minutes, staggered 5 minutes apart from each other. And then there it was.
That was it.
It was, yeah, it appeared. So it was like one of those songs that wrote itself in like 5 minutes. And then, yeah, you know, it's done pretty well for itself, you know, since then. So, yeah, and it's a love song. And there's just not a lot of bands that have one of their biggest songs as a love song, you know. So, you know, I'm pretty stoked about that, too.
Yeah.
I was reading about it, and there was a piece from years ago saying, and news of the video for Maps spread, and demands for downloads on Napster skyrocketed, and I felt quite, like, nostalgic for, like, wow, Napster. Well, oh, yeah. Oh, downloads. Right. It was like sort of thing, like a sort of sepia-toned photograph of, like, what things were like back then. It was like, ah, oh, Napster.
It's oh, dear. Yeah, we've seen a lot in the last, like, 15 years. It's just been, like, lightning speed changes in the music industry. But yeah, I mean, like, that song making it to, like, a Beyonce song and everything. I mean, it just, yeah, just, I don't get it. It just had a life of its own, basically, so.
How was it having the dichotomy of, if there is much of a difference between the expectation to view as a performer and then when you're not performing? Because everyone has that if you're in a band. There is a certain expectation of, like, well, we're going to go and see ... Mm-hmm. This is what we want to get.
Yeah.
And that brings with it a certain pressure to be that person that people expect.
Oh, you mean like in just like day-to-day life?
I mean, there's you know, like, you're going to do a gig. Are you going to be spontaneous? What? So you're asking me if I'm going to be spontaneous. Mm-hmm. You know, that's... Mm-hmm. I can't imagine that's... Especially when things kind of really got ridiculous. Mm. I guess that was quite difficult.
Yeah, I mean, it was, for me, like, who I am, you know, off stage versus who I am on stage is just... It's just so radically different, to the point where, like, I could get off stage 5 minutes later after being off, you know, off stage, no one even recognized, you know.
Like, the whole demeanor is so different.
Yeah, I'm so different. Like, literally, yeah, even, like, as soon as I'm off stage, it's like I take off the mask, the superhero mask, no one knows, like, you know, all of a sudden put the glasses on. And then no one knows who I am. I mean, that's, like, how different I am between, you know, being on stage and off stage. So something does really kind of happen up there for me. It is a kind of bliss. It's difficult to describe, and I very rarely, almost never, have any recollection of the show.
Really?
Yeah. And that's when I don't drink too, because in those early days I drank a lot. But that's also when I'm nearly sober up there. It's just what happens up there. It's like a dream. Like, it just, like, doesn't really, you know, it's, I'm just somewhere else, you know. But as far as expectations go, in those early days, it was I think the more difficult thing about that was just that I had set myself up as like as being a pretty spectacular, self-destructive sort of you know persona up there, and I felt like, you know, I was kind of needing to live up to that, you know, to a certain degree.
Exactly.
Yeah, right.
That's what I mean.
And until I fell off the stage, and then I had to sort of recalibrate all of like, you know, the way that I thought about performing, which was really, you know, it was good. It was difficult, but I'm glad, you know, that I did fall off the stage in a way, because it was like, it was not sustainable, you know, that level of self-destructive behavior up there. So, yeah.
Yeah.
That was, of course, Date with the Night by the Yeah Yeah Yeahs, their first UK Top 20 from their first album, Fever to Tell, in 2003, featuring my guest here on The First Time this week, Karen O.
This is BBC Radio
6
Music.
Now on BBC Sounds.
6 Music.
Gold line's gonna tell me where the light is. Gold line's gonna tell me where the light is. Take our hands out of control. Take our hands out of control. Now tell me what you saw. Tell me what you saw. There was crowd of seas inside, outside. I must have done a dozen each. It was the height I grew, the weight the shell was crushing you. I've been around a few. Tell me what you saw. I'll tell you what to. Oh, 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 oh.
I'm Matt Everett, and welcome back. This is The First Time on 6 Music, where we look at the key first moments in an artist's career. And my guest this week is Karen O, and that was Gold Lion, the first single to be taken from Yeah Yeah Yeahs' second album, Show Your Bones, in 2003. So The First Time is all about musical firsts, including the very first time people hear artists that they fall in love with. Should we talk about Nina Simone?
Yeah, I discovered Nina freshman year in college at Oberlin College in Ohio and in the States, and they had a little music store in the college town, and I was just like rifling through and found this record. I didn't know who she was, and it wasn't, you know, that interesting of a cover, but I just like I grabbed the CD.
back when we had CDs.
Yes. And brought it back to my dorm, popped it in the CD player, and it was her record called Live at Village Gate. Do you know that one? Mm-hmm. It is, oh my God, still one of my favorite Nina Simone records. And it was really bizarre because, you know, I started listening to it and I was like, I thought, like, it looks like it's, you know, it looks like a woman on the cover of this, but her voice is so, she has, like, got this androgynous voice, so deep, and, like, and even just, like, sort of the style of it, you know, wasn't, like, you know, sort of overtly feminine, right? So, like, but so soulful and so strong. And so I was confused. I was like, you know, is this a man or is this a woman? And I love that. I love that. So I love when you can't tell, you know? And it just completely floored me. There's a song on that record still that just, like, I think is just, like, one of the most gut-wrenching, heart-wrenching pieces of music I've ever heard in my life. You know, I was an instant fan from that moment on. And I do think that she's one of the greatest artists of all time, so.
Which song should we play then?
You want to hear that song?
Yeah.
Okay. He Was Too Good to Me by Nina Simone.
He was too good to me. How can I get along now? So close he stood to me. Everything's all messed up and wrong now. My baby would have brought me the sun, 'cause making me smile, that was his fun. When I was mean to him, he didn't say, go away now. You see, I was his queen to him. Who's gonna make me gay now? It's only natural that I'm blue, 'cause my baby was too good to be true. When I was mean to him, he didn't say, go away now. I was his queen to him. Who's gonna make me gay now? It's only natural. Said it's only natural.
The World Things Are again recently.
Oh yeah, I haven't seen that since.
It's really interesting because I watched it after reading about how Harold and Maude was a big kind of jumping off point for you.
Stevens
album.
Cat Stevens.
Because when you watch the film, the songs are really prominently placed throughout the whole thing.
Mm.
And it's kind of funny going back and watching it again without the expectation, you enjoy it a lot more.
Yeah.
Did you enjoy it? Because it's a hallowed text.
Yeah, it is.
Did you enjoy the process?
Yeah, it was kind of, it was awesome.
You seem a bit hesitant in this particular...
Well, everything is like, I mean, for me, it's like everything's a bit pain because I'm just like, it's just a bloodbath in my head. That's part about being a sensitive artist, you know, but it's also just like blissful too. Like, you know, so there's always the duality of the two, bliss and just like utter suffering. But like,
it's very difficult to extricate the work.
Where's the middle ground?
Life.
Where's the middle ground?
Yeah.
But yeah, that was.
I'm sorry. I feel bad now for asking you about it.
No. Actually, that was an amazing process because I was like, I was a kid, you know, I was like, I don't know, when I started, I was like 26 or something like this, right? And I just got all my friends, my buddies, and from other bands, you know, to do it with me, you know, and we just have these sessions. And Spike was just sending us the raw footage that was coming in before, like, anyone had seen it even, just like straight from Australia, I think, where he was shooting it, just so I could just get a vibe for, like, what he was doing, you know? And then we just start writing music to that. And I just had my buddies around me, like Bradford Cox from, you know, from Deer Hunter, and some guys from the Raconteurs, and Nick and Brian, and it was just like my friends. Yeah, we just like, I would just like a melody would pop into my head, and then we would just start like, you know, jamming on it, and we did a bulk of the music before, you know, they even started cutting the film, you know. So
that's not the way it's supposed to work, is it?
No, not usually. But it really, like, they loved having it because it just helped, you know, influence just like certain ways that they, and I guess they cut it, or the motions that they were playing off of. But yeah, we did a bunch of sessions like that, and then Spike had to hire Carter Burwell to do the rest of to do the rest of it, because he actually had a lot of music in there, and you know, I wasn't so good at like score per se as much as like kind of like doing these themes, I guess. Mm-hmm. You know, so like we kind of did the themes and Carter did like a lot of the score, so.
See, now I feel bad about asking you about Crush songs, because that was also another deeply personal piece of work.
I do a lot of personal stuff.
Well, yeah, I mean, yeah, this seems like a stupid thing to say, but yeah, I mean, it is always personal, but that seemed like, I was going to say, a very brave kind of first solo piece of work.
It seemed to make the most sense, though, for me, like, because what I liked the most about it was just that, you know, I was writing, yeah, they're like kind of these bedroom demos, literally like written in bed, or like, you know.
Bed.
Bed demos.
Actual bed demo.
they're these bed demos. Like in beds, like, you know, my bed, hotel beds, like when I was on tour. It was like, it was as like intimate as you get. And really, like, I was writing them not because I was like, oh, you know, I'm going to turn this into a record one day. It was just because writing music for me, or making music for me, isn't so much something like I want to do. It's something that I need to do. There's a difference, you know. Some people make music because they want to make music. I make music because I literally have to make music. Otherwise, you know, like, I need that outlet. Otherwise, it's just, I have trouble in life, you know. So, like,
bad things happen if you don't get it out.
Bad things could happen. So I was writing that music, and I was, you know, just a very lovelorn young woman. And a lot of those songs were, you know, about my sort of search for love. And it's a lot of ups and downs with that search for love. But, it, you know, it was never intended on being released, and so there was just like a sort of an innocence and a naivete and like a purity about them that you don't get when you set out to make a record, you know, so much. And I thought that'd be a nice first solo thing to release, because it just was so pure and personal, and I just thought, like, you know, after doing, you know, a few studio records, or three or four studio records with a band, and I just thought it'd be like, you know, a nice thing to put out there. It's something that I like to listen to, and other people who do that, I've always, like, you know, kind of loved PJ Harvey's 4-track demos was a big one. Even, like, you know, this other record that I found a bit later was Michael Cera. He's the actor. He did a record, and it's just like that too. It's just like him doing these little songs. He never intended on releasing them, and it resonates with me because there's like a purity about it, you know, just like when you kind of release something that was never really intended on.
1, 2, 3, go. Let my baby in New York City. Oh, what a pity he's in New York City. 'Cause my arms are empty and the phone it rings at plenty. But I'd rather have my baby much, much closer to me lately than he's been.
How does it feel when Yeah Yeahs kind of regroups to do these events?
Feels good, yeah. Feels good. It's nice because we do like 5 to 12 shows a year.
It's a very civilized way of working, isn't it? Just a little bit.
50 to 100. So it's almost like, because I'm a parent now too, it's almost like a workation, you know. I don't usually bring my son Django, you know, we go somewhere and we stay somewhere nice and we like get together. We feel like, of course, tremendous pressure and suffering the 3 hours before we go on, but then we go on. then we go on there. It's like such a massive release and
celebratory.
Super celebrate. Yeah. And depending on the crowd, but most of the crowds have been, you know, really embrace, you know, because they haven't seen us in like 10 years or something like that. They're excited to see us, and there's just like we're feeding off of them. They're feeding off of us, and it's just like. It's really cathartic and beautiful. So it's nice to keep it kind of like just a few. It'd be nice. I'm sure there's places that haven't seen us for a long time that are like, come on, just get over here, you know, and we will. We'll get there. But like, you know, it's been really wonderful just doing these like short bursts, you know.
That's the way to do it. Don't split up. Just pick the moment. Come back.
Don't worry. We won't split up.
You've talked a lot about first meeting Brian for this record. But what were your first impressions of him? Because he is... His media-facing kind of character is quite reserved, quite shy, quite reticent.
Yeah.
But what were your impressions of him when you met him? What are you laughing?
I mean, yeah, probably all those things, you know. I thought, like, yeah, he seemed pretty buttoned up and reserved and stuff, but cool, you know. Like, he had, like, a cool, he was cool-looking and, you know, kind of put together nicely. And... And just like I could tell, someone who just you know, he likes a lover of retro things, which I also love. So
when he enters a room,
you
kind of know about it, even though he's not making a big deal of himself.
Yeah, and his reputation kind of precedes him too. You know, he's even back then, which is kind of really kind of met like probably around 2006 or 2007 that I remember. You know, he's still, I mean, he was just, you know, very accomplished and very respected and well-respected and stuff. So, but yeah, but I also like, you know, those type of people, I just want to like poke them and get a rise out of them. So get in there, you know, and see what they're really about. And I got a chance to do that. He's like, you know, he's a classic fellow, you know, I'd say. So
it's been good to speak to you. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much. Thanks.
Sun on the glass, no darkness. Six Music.
Interested in just mishmashing the sound and see what you get.
Straight up bangers, obscure gems, and long forgotten favorites.
Well, we don't have a set list. We're trying to ensure that every show is different.
This is Alt Noughties on BBC Sounds.